Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Hi, welcome to Eat Your Heartland Out. This is Capri Cafaro, your host, and this is a show all about the intersection of food and culture in the American Midwest. We are excited to welcome today James Norton. He is a man of many talents. He is an author of a number of books, which we are going to talk about, and he is also the founder and editor of Heavy Table, which is a super blog and many, many other things coming out of the upper Midwest. So we want to welcome you, James. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So just a little teaser there on some of the things that you've been up to, but I kind of want to start with, you know, once upon a time, your origin story, because you have a pretty interesting, I think, and almost circuitous journey to where you are today, something that I definitely relate to as personally, as someone who has kind of had a very unique winding road from where my career started to where I am now. So tell our listeners a bit about, you know, where you started and ultimately how that got you where we are today.
Yeah, I jumped into journalism back around the turn of the millennium, doing hard news, actually, I was a Middle East news editor for the Christian Science Monitor in Boston.
It does not get more hardcore than that, let's be honest, particularly at that time in life. Christian Science Monitor, Boston, and Middle East.
It was an exciting exciting period in that region, although, you know, that region tends to stay lively. And so, yeah, that's kind of how I got rolling in the journalism business. And 4 or 5 years after that, I actually made a jump into radio, and I was working with Al Franken, who later became a senator for the state of Minnesota, as he started his radio show in New York City. So I kind of went from, you know, straight news journalism into partisan talk radio, and then the radio show moved to Minneapolis-St. Paul, which brought me into the beautiful upper Midwest part of the country. And I started doing some, basically some freelancing in the world of food and drink. And as my interest in politics kind of diminished, my interest in the way people eat and drink and talk about all things culinary really began to spike. And I kind of transitioned my career from hard news into all things edible.
Well, you make me feel less strange, having gone from a life in public service and government and public policy to, a world of, you know, culture and culinary and all of those things that you just discussed. Are you a Midwest native?
I am. I grew up and went to college in Madison, Wisconsin.
That's my
home city.
So you have those Midwestern roots already, and you came back thanks to Al Franken, you got inspired somewhere along the line and shifted your focus. What if anything really was there a specific precipitating moment where you're like, you know what? This is why I really love the subject of food and drink and culture. Was there that one little spark that kind of got you going in a different direction?
You know, I think the really key turning point was starting work on the book, The Master Cheesemakers of Wisconsin, you know, obviously I grew up in Wisconsin. I knew that we had great cheese. I enjoyed a slice of cheese from time to time. but it was kind of the process of digging into just how deep these traditions were, just how skillful these makers were, how varied and like widely spread the different traditions were, that made me think, oh, this has been here under our noses in plain sight the whole time, but we just don't really recognize that the cheese of Wisconsin is such a incredible, internationally recognized, fantastic thing. I think we tend to overlook it and think, oh, well, Vermont is fancier, or California mm-hmm. is bigger, or France is the world's best. And actually getting on the road and going to these cheese plants, talking to these makers, made me think, oh my goodness, there's this incredibly deep, serious food tradition here in the upper Midwest that I didn't really see. And that kicked off a number, and we could talk more about this as we go, a number of different explorations into things in Wisconsin, in Minnesota, mm-hmm. beyond, where, you know, there's just excellent work being done, often underappreciated, but, you know, as delicious as anything you can eat anywhere on the planet.
Absolutely. And I do want to circle back to that. And I do want to dig deeper into your book about Wisconsin master cheesemakers. But I want to go back into this, you know, concept of how did you want to write a book about cheese? I mean, there had to be something around you that said, you know, I want to explore this as opposed to, you know, what I'm doing now. Now, and I recognize that there's sort of two separate things probably going on. One is a, you know, diminishing interest in what you were doing as far as politics, but an increasing interest in this, you know, sort of food and drink and culture world. But, you know, what brought you to the cheese book?
Well, the inciting incident was my wife and I were taking a cross-country road trip, and we ended up in San Francisco at the Ferry Building. Mm. And we were at a cheesemonger there, and it turned out the cheesemonger was from Minnesota. And so we were talking about Midwestern cheese, and she just started chatting with us about the Wisconsin Master Cheesemaker Program and how they yes. take these journeymen or master cheesemakers who already know their stuff, bring them back to an academic environment, train them up even further, and give them this sort of master's mark. And my wife, Becca, and I were so interested in this and so curious about it and so excited about it. And we were driving north up to Portland, Oregon after that. And we're in the car, and I don't remember if it was her or I, one of us said, oh, wouldn't it be interesting, you know, to meet the people who are so fanatic about cheese that they become professional cheesemakers and then go back and get the certification. And, you know, Becca's a photographer, I'm a writer. So here's this chance for us to kind of work.
It's a great partnership.
It's a great partnership. Here's this chance for us to work together and tell this very clearly defined story. And one of the nice things about a clearly defined story, not only does it tell you, it cuts your work out for you, you know what you're doing. It's easier to pitch. You can take it to a publishing house, mm-hmm. as we did, and say, hey, here's specifically what we want to do. Here's the limits of it, the outer extents of it. What do you think? Does this make a good book?
Yeah. How long did it take you to assemble and do the research?
I think it was about 7 or 8 months, and we did about 7,200 miles of driving on Wisconsin roads. We talked to 42 cheesemakers at 35 different dairy plants.
Wow.
And we got to basically every part of the state in the course of doing the book.
So what did you learn on this cheese road trip of yours that turned into a book?
Well, we learned a lot, but one of the things that really struck me is just I didn't fully appreciate that Wisconsin has third, fourth, even fifth generation cheesemakers, mm-hmm. often with ancestry going right back to Germany,
Switzerland
or Italy. And so it's not just people came to Wisconsin, thought cows would be good here. I wonder if we can try to make cheese. It's people who in their bones knew what they were doing and had traditions that they were tapping into. Another thing that we learned is that there's also tremendous innovation. You know, you get to the third and fourth and fifth generation, and people start playing with mixed milks and adjunct ingredients and new techniques. And so you've got cheese as traditional as it comes, you know, like really classic cheddars and Limburgers and stuff like that. But you also have cheeses that were invented in Wisconsin, like Colby and Brick, and then these new you know, it's sheep's milk and cow's milk and goat's milk, or it's rubbed with fennel pollen, or it's got stinging nettles mixed into the gouda, like things like that, like just really exciting, interesting things that you don't often find other places. So you've got deep tradition, you've got innovation, and you've got it all going on in one place. And so you get out there and start talking to people, and it's just exciting to discover that breadth. And it's also really interesting, particularly the smaller kind of craft cheesemakers, just how multi-talented these people are. They're jacks of all trades or jills of all trades. They do their own plumbing. They do their own electrical work. They drive the truck. I mean, they do everything, because
absolutely,
if they don't do it, they don't have the margins to survive. So they're these incredible hustlers who know dozens of different skills at a deep level. And some of these guys are in their, you know, we met them, their late 50s, early 60s, even late 60s, running around on milk trucks, grabbing cheese out of vats, hauling, you know, wheels around. I'm like, I don't think I could do that. Like, it just athletic and fireballs of energy and creativity.
And all fueled by that passion for cheese.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the thing about cheese. It's like, it's one of those bottomless pools. It's like wine or even beer you know, a number of other different foods where you start to get into it. Bread, for example, you start to explore it and you're like, oh my gosh, there's no bottom to this. I can always learn more. I can always get a new technique. I can always try a new region or tradition. It doesn't get boring. It's infinitely interesting.
Is there anything that really surprised you when you met these cheesemakers? Whether it was, you know, maybe a technique or just a flavor profile that you never anticipated?
One of the interesting tidbits that I picked up on is a cheese called Ystävällisyyslipa, which is a Finnish cheese that's made in Wisconsin. I hadn't heard of it before doing this book, but it's actually produced in fairly good quantities. And it's called a bread cheese. You can actually put it on a griddle or a grill and sear it, and it won't melt.
So kind of like a halloumi.
Exactly. And in Finland, one of the things they do with it is you'll cut it in a little block and you'll drop it in your coffee, and it'll sit at the bottom of your coffee and get really soft and release some of that lactose into your coffee. And
you fascinating. Eat the super,
yeah. Isn't that weird? And you'll eat the little super soft cheese at the end of your cup of coffee. Not so in Wisconsin. The cheese has gone savory. It's gone salty instead of sweet. And it's something that you will grill up before a football game and serve as an appetizer. So in a sense, it's a very traditional Finnish style cheese, but it's been reinterpreted and reinvented in Wisconsin. And like, I don't know, it's just a little quirky thing, but it was something I didn't know before. And it was really fun to learn and to taste. Yeah.
I bet.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
I know you have at least one more book that you have written more recently, but before we kind of venture on into that, I want to talk to you about one of your major projects that you have been kind of working on and around for almost, you know, almost two decades, and that is Heavy Table. So explain what that is all about and how it got started.
So Heavy Table got its start about 2009, as an advertiser-supported blog. I ran it until about 2018 in that format, took a break, and got a food editor job at a magazine called The Growler in St. Paul for about 2 years. The pandemic popped up, wrecked The Growler, And I restarted Heavy Table as a Patreon-backed newsletter, and that's its current format. Over the years, we've published probably about 3 million words about Upper Midwestern food. We've had dozens of regular contributors who've been all over the region, but we're particularly heavy in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metro.
Sure.
And it's just been like a blank check to explore Upper Midwestern food, tell the stories that really mean the most to me and our contributors and our readers, and kind of get beyond the surface of our region. That's mm-hmm. been the neatest thing about it, is we can ask deep questions, do long interviews, and go to places other people don't bother going.
Well, I mean, that's definitely aspects that I think drew me to your work, is that willingness to, you know, dig a little deeper and, you know, really highlight some of the complexities and the gems of the Upper Midwest. For folks that aren't necessarily as familiar as certainly you or maybe even me with the Minneapolis-St. Paul area and aspects of the Upper Midwest, give a little taste, literally and figuratively, of, you know, what makes this region unique and diverse when it comes to what's offered on the table there.
I would describe it as kind of a Germanic Scandinavian bedrock of home food, comfort food, folk food mm-hmm. that kind of resonates in the region. And then there's been fine dining here forever, mostly in, you know, typical sort of French-inspired continental fashion. And
right.
that's the stuff that's it's easy to see that I think everybody knows about. What's really exciting here for me, not that that stuff isn't exciting, because there actually is really cool aspects to that stuff I first mentioned. But what's really exciting to me is that we've had these waves of immigration come, particularly to the Twin Cities, and really change the way people eat and drink. St. Paul University Avenue, particularly, there's an incredible wealth of Southeast Asian food, Hmong, Vietnamese, Cambodian, Thai, Lao, like all this stuff, first generation people cooking for other first generation people, and just doing like an incredible job. Anthony Bourdain came here and said it was the best Vietnamese food he'd had outside of Vietnam. And I haven't
that's
been
saying
to
something.
That's saying something. The guy knew what he was talking about. There's also an incredible East African diaspora.
Mm-hmm.
And so Eritrean, Ethiopians, Somali, those restaurants are all over the place and they're available and they're really good. And particularly in East Lake Street here in Minneapolis, there is a real Latin, Mexican, Central American population, and you can get incredible tacos here in you know, roast chicken and rice and beans, other traditional Mexican foods that I think if you're just coming in through the airport and you haven't been here before, you would never guess. But
right.
There's just terrific Latin food, and it gets overlooked, and it's really on the rise. I think that one of the things I've been doing with Heavy Table that I'm excited about is watching immigrant populations, Asian populations, Latin populations, get to the second and third generations. And you get mm-hmm. these restaurateurs who come out who have the connection to these authentic eating traditions and super rich, bright flavors. And they're also very savvy about how to market to a general audience.
Yes.
So you're starting to see this, like, really, I hate to use the word authentic, but like really deep, complex food reaching out to like a broader audience in a more accessible way. And so it's really changing the character of the restaurants around here in a great way.
Well, and I think it's one of these things that once again reflect the fact and the power of food to transcend, right? To bring people together, to educate people about, you know, different cultures that they may have not necessarily had exposure to otherwise, and bringing down those barriers where, you know, and I'm sure that as you mentioned, you know, some of these newer generations, these younger that have been here 2, 3, 4 generations now, are savvy, you know, to marketing to a general audience, maybe to an even younger audience. And so you're getting that wider reach. But I think that, you know, when food is one of these ways in which people are, I think, more willing to maybe take some risks, you know, learn something about a different culture, taste something different, that they would never necessarily have an opportunity to do in their daily life. But because it's there on offer at a restaurant or a food hall or whatever it might be, all of a sudden, that's that doorway. That's that access point to explore new culture and new flavors.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's totally right. I think, and I think if you're particularly, if you're in one of these little family owned places on University Avenue or Central Avenue or wherever, like, and you come into that restaurant, you're coming into someone's house, you know, like this is a family that's serving often a lot of their friends or people from towns nearby where they emigrated from. And it's kind of a humbling feeling. And it really changes you a little bit as a person, as a diner. It introduces you to new flavors, new cultures, makes you more comfortable in the world at large as well.
Absolutely.
Which is one of my favorite things about dining adventurously and widely is, you know, when I travel internationally, it's less intimidating. It's more fun. It's more inviting.
No question about it. And I think what we're describing are things, again, that you and I know I think to use your words in one of our conversations, Midwestern evangelists in a certain way,
yeah.
Understanding that, you know, there are these incredible, diverse communities all throughout the Midwest and, you know, big cities and small towns and, you know, they're bringing their different food traditions with them. That's exactly what I think you're reflecting is the fact of the matter is that, you know, maybe people are thinking, you know, Minnesota is just this, you know, place of kind of Scandinavian smoked fish, and don't realize that there is an East African diaspora and, you know, an incredible Southeast Asian presence. And I think that's the benefit of what you're doing with the reach of Heavy Table.
Yeah. And I get so frustrated when I read people on either coast just sort of reducing or overlooking what's going on in the upper Midwest and not understanding kind of the depth of the flavors that are available here and the people who are cooking and eating here. And it's made me much less prone to overlooking things myself. Like, I don't know anything about the food of Oklahoma. I'm not going to sneer at it. I haven't been there. I don't know. It could be incredible. And I think 20 years ago, I'd be like, yeah, there's nothing to eat there. Or like, oh, Kansas has got nothing. Or, you know, I would say right. ignorant stuff based on geography. And I don't do that anymore.
And again, it's all thanks to food. Now, this brings me to something that I wanted you to absolutely tell our listeners about. And that is your Feb-skiving tradition, because you mentioned this to me before.
Yeah.
And it's something that you kind of revel in to bring people from all over the country to experience what you now know about the Midwest.
Yeah, we're on year, I don't know, 14 or 15 of this. I could track it down. It's not super important. But not long after moving here, I realized that every February, I get incredibly depressed because it's dark and it's cold and it's miserable. And the winter just seems like it will never die. Like
you are not alone. And, you know, I know that people might be listening to this podcast at any time, but right now we are in a bit of a polar vortex as we record.
Yeah. So it feels like permanent winter and there's no hope. There's no light. There's nothing going on. And so my wife and I thought, well, why don't we just throw a really big dinner party called Feb-giving? It'll basically be Thanksgiving menu, but copy pasted into the middle of February. And so we did that. And it turns out if you plan a big party like that, you've got to do a lot of like work beforehand and cleaning the house and making the menu and doing the shopping and getting the recipes and inviting the people and all this, you know, mishigas that kind of surrounds it. And suddenly you're busy for weeks before this thing and you're not thinking about how depressed you are and how dark it is. You're excited to see friends and excited to see family. And like, it's kind of fun. And so we did it, you know, at our house with about 10 or 11 people. And we started having friends come in from out of state. And then we started having friends fly in from both coasts. And now we're up to, I don't know, 25 to 30 people plus a bunch of kids. We rent some geodesic domes out in the suburbs and like set up camp and have like a three or four day party. And it's this way to reconnect with people that we absolutely love and don't see often enough who come into Minnesota in February from all parts of the country.
That's commitment. That's commitment.
Yeah, well, it's
on all parts, because you got to get to Minnesota.
Yeah,
you know, you're braving the elements. As a guest and all those things, and then you know, you and your wife and your family as hosts have as you said, a lot of work to do.
Oh, it's a huge undertaking, and it's so much fun. It's so joyous. And like all this work and all this fussing and planning and menu editing and blah, 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 and kid activity programming, et cetera, like it's distracting. And so from mid-January to, you know, mid-February, we are 100% kind of thinking about this and excited about it and busy. And it's turned winter into this thing we look forward to. It's one of the highlights of our entire year. And the summers here are gorgeous and wonderful. And we love them and we're busy and we're active. And like, that's a great thing. But now suddenly winter's become this time that is really precious and awesome too.
Well, it sounds like a win-win to me and an absolute blast. And I think maybe inspiring me and maybe some of our listeners to try something similar, if not maybe on a smaller scale, but something for folks to look forward to, you know, in these dark, cold winter months for those of us that, you know, are in the Midwest or the Great Lakes or any place that's cold, which apparently seems to be the entirety
everywhere
of the United States right now. Now, you mentioned a couple things. You mentioned camp and you mentioned summertime. Now, I know you don't do this anymore, but I wanted you to talk about it anyway, which is Chef Camp Minnesota.
Yeah. So for about five iterations, I think over the course of 3 or 4 years, me and my business partner, Dave Friedman, who has since moved out of state, which is sort of the end of this project, would rent an entire YMCA summer camp called Camp Miller, about an hour and a half north of Minneapolis. And we would book 4 or 5 really top flight chefs to be instructors and teach something that they know on open fires. So we have big grills and campfires and all kinds of like open fire kind of cooking opportunities. And we would sell tickets. We get, you know, 90 to like 120 people would come up for the whole weekend. And it would just be chef instruction. It would be foraging. We would have like a 6-course dinner on Saturday night. We'd have a chef-led brunch. A couple times we did canoe bars. We'd canoe out into the lake and there'd
How
be
a
canoe there with drinks for you. We'd burn Swedish torches, which are like logs burning vertically around a giant campfire. And it was so much fun. We had astronomy and fermentation and cooking a whole octopus on the grill and a Pachamanca berry grill and it was really a tremendous thing, and it was really fun to kind of embrace where we are in terms of the chefs being all Minneapolis, St. Paul people, and then getting out to the North Woods and like getting out there with the fresh air and the clean water and the fires burning outside. It was just a glorious time.
It sounds like it. I mean, again, like, you know, I want to continue to needle you to bring this back, but it sounds like just a great concept, one that I know takes a lot of work as well. But when I'm sure participants get a ton out of when it was going on. So Chef Camp Minnesota, put a pin in it because maybe it'll come back in a different iteration. I mean, you are you know, such an explorer of everything, you know, in this region and beyond. And I know that has produced another book. You've produced another book. You've written another book. And I'm certainly not going to let you go without talking about that one as well. And it's called Lake Superior Flavors. And I know it probably sounds exactly how it's described, but tell us a little bit more about that book and how you came to write it.
Yeah. So Lake Superior Flavors is another book in collaboration with my wife, Becca. So she did the photography. I did the interviews and writing. It's a kind of a field guide to the food and drink along the Circle Tour, taking you all the way around Lake
Yes.
Superior. So if you wanted to break that out into regions, it's kind of a story of food on Minnesota's north shore of Lake Superior and then into Ontario, Canada, like Thunder Bay. All the way over to Sault Ste. Marie.
Oh,
and then
down
through UP, Michigan, and then the south shore of Lake Superior, which is Wisconsin's kind of north coast. That's kind of how it breaks down. And it was really cool. We basically did the Circle Tour about 2.5 times. We made some other little trips up to kind of do research. And we went to restaurants. We met chefs. We went fishing with a herring fisherman in Lake Superior. We met a beekeeper. We went foraging.
Oh, wow.
We went, you know, met brewers and vintners and just kind of dug into the people making and celebrating food from the region of Lake Superior and tried to figure out what does that mean? What's it about? What are people eating and why? And it was a blast. It's a food book. It's also a travelogue, and it's really, it's really one of the most beautiful parts of the whole country. I think Lake Superior is very under-celebrated for how legitimately majestic and awe-inspiring that it is.
I couldn't agree more. There's no question about that. I mean, Lake Superior is beautiful. And I mean, just all the things that you just kind of touched upon at a very high level, so many from beekeepers to brewers, you know, there's obviously a lot to see, a lot to offer going out, you know, obviously on the lake and fishing. How did you identify the subjects that you ultimately featured? Did you stumble upon them or was it research, a little bit of both?
It's always a little bit of both. When I work on a trip like this, I have an itinerary that I've developed partially through my own sort of online research, but partially by talking to people I trust in these various places and saying, hey, here's my project. Who should I talk to? And right. Usually people say, oh, you got to talk to this person, or, oh, she's doing something really cool. And, you know, a lot will line up interviews in every sort of city or between cities as available so that we have a schedule as we make our drive. But then, you know, you just got to try eating at some random place or like, oh, we were in UP, for example, driving through the middle of a forest and like, oh, there's a bakery here in the middle of the forest for no reason. Like, we got to go check it out. So great interview, great bread, like really
that's
weird.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So you just kind of like, you have to be open to what the universe is giving you on top of doing some pre-planning. It's definitely a mix. I think a good travel writer, you know, has a plan and is not unwilling to abandon it if something more interesting comes along.
Or maybe total, you know, disaster and chaos. Any good stories like that where, you know, I don't know, the boat almost sank or, you know, you guys got snowed in someplace and couldn't get out?
We got caught in Canada during Canadian Thanksgiving, which we didn't plan for.
Which is in October for folks that don't know. It's not November.
As we did not know. So that was, I mean, it wasn't a disaster, but it was inconvenient and surprising. I mean, the scariest thing that happened on the trip for me is we went out herring fishing with this guy, Steve Dahl. We didn't know anything about it. It was like, oh, he's going to take us out fishing. Cool. His boat was just like this flat little thing that's like 3 inches off the lake. The life jackets were like pounded flat, 40 years old.
And
I don't like the water. I am not a water person. I am not a boat person. So it's like 5:30 in the morning. The sun is just coming up over the lake and we're on this tiny little skiff, like heading out into the waves. I'm just like, oh my God, this is where it ends. You know,
that would freak me out too, but it's a good story.
Yeah, the photography was beautiful. The interview was good and, you know, I survived, so it's fine. But it was more than I bargained for sure.
Yeah, but you know what? I mean, that is really what it's all about, you know, is not being afraid to take those risks, because that's really sometimes where you find the most compelling stuff and obviously timeless memories from something that you maybe wouldn't have done otherwise. If you weren't on this journey seeking out these stories from these individuals and these makers in these different ways. James, this has been such an exciting conversation for me, and to hear about all of your work has been inspiring and hopefully inspiring to our listener as well. For folks that want to learn more, how do they find your books and how do they find Heavy Table?
Yeah, I would just say go to heavytable.com or go to patreon.com/heavytable. And that's the best way to kind of connect with it. You can follow at a free level. If you back us for $5 a month, you get 4 newsletters, which are pretty substantial newsletters, one every Friday, telling you about food and drink in the upper Midwest. At the $10 level, it's actually 6 newsletters. So you can go heavy on it if you want. The books are available, I think mostly still available on Amazon. You can find them through my biography at Heavy Table. It's heavytable.com is probably your best starting point to catch up on what I've been doing.
Awesome. Well, folks, head to heavytable.com. We really appreciate your time and sharing with us your story, your journey, and your work. This has been so much fun. James Norton, thank you for taking your time to join Eat Your Heartland Out.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast.
You've been listening to Eat Your Heartland Out. This episode was produced by me, Capri Cafaro. Our audio engineers are Liam Werner and Armin Spengen. Theme music by Jason Shaw. You can learn more about the show by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/eatyourheartlandout. Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.